The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his long-haired roadie, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 80 of The Big Picture for the week beginning October 9th. And coming up on today's show, hope rises with Hillsong United, even as the world falls into Dan Brown's inferno.
We also go looking for the girl on the train and find a mystery worthy of Hitchcock.
And Batman is back. The real Batman. No body armor, just 100% pure Adam West.
Hello, mate. How you going?
Mate, it's good to be here.
It always is good to be here. And now, before we get to talking about, what did you say? No body armor, just 100% pure Adam West.
That's right.
Batman is back. Before we get to that, here's what else is happening around the traps this week. At cinemas, Deep Water Horizon open. You reviewed this on the show last week. You can check out Mark's review at thebigpicturewebsite.com. This movie that somehow turns an environmental catastrophe, a real life environmental catastrophe, into a story of human heroics and our need for God. And according to you, Mark, it's worth seeing.
It is indeed, as you say, worth seeing.
As you say.
Then again, I'm not sure the same can be said for what I'm about to tell you. X Factor Season 7 kicked off again this week. Thank you, Channel 7.
Aren't you a fan of those shows?
I am a fan of The Voice.
Don't
you see those shows? Can't you see the distinction?
They're called two different things. So X Factor's back.
That's right. X Factor's back. It's on Mondays. The X Factor Next Generation has two new superstar judges, Iggy Azalea and Adam Lambert, joining.
It sounds like you know them very well.
I don't know these people. Look, I'm sure that the kids know, and that's the important thing, isn't it, parents? Honestly, if you could just roll this name off and not make a mistake, you go up 10 points in your kids' eyes. But look, certainly I'm going downhill now. Well, anyway, they're joining X Factor heavyweight Guy Sebastian to unearth Australia's next singing sensation, so you can find them on Monday nights.
Let Hope Rise is at cinemas, Mark. As you mentioned in the intro, this Hillsong documentary has finally reached our shores. It was produced out of Hollywood. It's about the phenomena of the Hillsong United band, how it started in Sydney and blew up and took over the world, one of the most popular Christian bands on the planet. We got to interview Taya Smith, lead singer of Hillsong United, this week, and that's coming up on the show very soon.
Yes, and indeed, something I'm actually really looking forward to seeing is episode 1 of Man Up on the ABC. It starts
Man Up.
Tuesday. Now, this is really interesting.
It's a great name for a show.
Yeah, it is, actually. It's until you hear the topic.
Oh.
Okay. Well, no, it's still a great name. This Tuesday at 8:30 p.m. on the ABC, Man Up starts. Now, that's Gus Warlin, who's embarking on a journey to discover just why it is that men across Australia are taking their own lives at alarming rates.
Oh.
Yeah, so motivated by his own mate Angus's unexpected suicide, Gus wants to find out if the traditional masculine ideals that tell men to harden up, man up, are in fact making them crack.
Wow.
I think this is going to be a very interesting examination of our culture. So let me encourage you to tune into the ABC on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think I will. In some entertainment news, Mark, the Hobbit and Sherlock and Fargo star, Martin Freeman, is in Australia because he's working on a new film, Cargo. Now, I reckon if you want to get Martin Freeman to star in your script, you should name it something that rhymes with Fargo, like Cargo. So maybe if you do a script called Embargo.
Do you think actually that it came across his desk and he went and just misread it?
Cargo. Oh, yeah.
So yeah. That's the new series, isn't it? What are the Coen brothers doing?
So Martin Freeman's in Australia in Cargo. He's playing Andy, a guy who's become infected. He knows he's only got 48 hours to live and he's trying to save his baby. It's got something to do with zombies, but according to Martin Freeman, it's not a zombie movie. This movie will be out in the next couple of years. Cargo, not Fargo.
Just underlining, not a zombie movie, though may have zombies in it.
That's right.
Okay. Look, we'll be talking about some superhero mayhem shortly in What Your Kids Are Watching. So it only seems fair to let you know that Luke Cage has arrived on Netflix. Now, Luke Cage, played by the charismatic Mike Coulter, made its television debut as a supporting character in last year's Netflix series Marvel's Jessica Jones. He returns today as the star of his own series, Marvel's Luke Cage. I think you just take a normal name and put Marvel's in front of it.
That's right. Marvel's Ben McKechin coming soon.
That would be really good to see. I'd like to see that.
It would be the most boring show you've ever seen.
I don't know.
Unlike Luke Cage, which I presume would be kind of interesting.
Yes, well, the new Netflix program follows Cage's life as a wrongfully convicted man and widower. You could have your life as a wrongfully convicted hat wearer. Something like that. Anyway, look.
And that's about a 5-minute episode.
Okay. But actually, it's all going to culminate in Marvel's superheroes Daredevil and Iron Fist and also Jessica Jones teaming up for Marvel's Defenders. with the Defenders, which starts next year.
Sure.
So it's all sort of pieces of this great big Marvel universe.
Okay.
Marvelous.
We are almost at you telling us all about Batman Return of the Caped Crusaders. Before we get to that, though, Mark, it's time for True or False for this week's edition of The Big Picture. Last week on the show, I rattled off the top five Tim Burton movies. You can check out that list at thebigpicturewebsite.com. I'll give you a sneak peek, though, if you missed it last week. One of those choices was Tim Burton's Batman from the late 80s. So here's a true or false statement, and you've got to work out whether this is indeed true or false. So, costume designer Bob Ringwood on Tim Burton's Batman came up with 25 different cape looks and 6 different head looks for Michael Keaton's Batman outfit. Did the Bob Ringwood costume designer create 25 different cape looks and 6 different head looks for the Batman suit for Tim Burton to pick from? True or false?
How many different ways can you do pointy ears?
Apparently 25. Six.
Or six.
As the case may be.
Mate, I look forward to finding that out.
We'll find out the answer to that once we've talked about in what our kids are watching this week. We thought we'd take a special look at the rise and rise of the Caped Crusader. Now, chances are, if there's a little boy in your household, you've probably been dragged into the toy aisle to have a look at the latest Batman toys, or you've been persuaded to buy your own little superhero his first cape and mask. The Dark Knight film trilogy, helmed by Christopher Nolan, was certainly an adults-only franchise, but it heralded the return of the Gotham Bat to children's entertainment. So this week, Mark brings us up to speed with the latest child-friendly Batman, soon to hit Australian screens, beginning with The Return of the Caped Crusaders.
Holy entree, Batman.
You fiends, you will rue this day.
The only rue here is in the gravy.
All right, Caped Crusader, you're our only hope. Not so fast.
But we're in a hurry, Batman.
Jaywalking is extremely hazardous.
Gosh, yes, you're right, Batman.
Quickly, Robin, to the crosswalk.
Mark, it's just so good.
If you're a person who was born before the internet was born, I think that there might be some familiar sounding Batman-ness in that clip. Do I actually recognize the dulcet tones of one Adam West?
That's right. The original TV Batman, Adam West.
The original TV
to the big
Batman
screen.
Is back. I know. How old is Adam West?
Adam West is actually pushing, let me see if I can get
the exact 80? 80
he's
something?
88.
88.
He's 88 years old.
He's back
old
on
now.
Screen because yep. When was the original Batman TV show?
The
out?
Original Batman TV show was in the 60s.
Yep.
And so now, and he was actually born in 1928, so he was fairly old when he did the television series.
Whoa.
I know.
So what is going on with the return of Batman, of Adam West, the original Batman?
Well, what's basically happening is that Bruce Wayne, better known as the Caped Crusader, Batman, has returned, but Warner Brothers has brought him back in an animated format. There's this whole sort of retro thing going on with Batman at the moment. And so, and timed with this too, Lego is re-releasing all of its Batman products.
Of course
but in
it
a
is.
Retro style, too, yeah. So you can actually buy now all the retro Batman collection.
And this is heading towards the Lego Batman movie that I think's coming out next year.
Indeed. I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. But yeah, The Return of the Caped Crusader is basically a feature-length animation, and the animation will receive a limited cinema release in Australia, but then it's going to kick on fairly promptly to digital release and DVD and, all in time for Christmas. Wouldn't that be a strange one? But anyway, so that's going to happen. The whole plot line is pretty, you'll be shocked when you hear, but apparently
yes,
the Joker, the Penguin, the Riddler, and Catwoman are collaborating on a nefarious plot.
Kapow!
I know, which will see Batman and Robin head off into space.
You have me at head off into space.
I know.
That's a great plot line.
It is, and they've got to save Gotham City, apparently, under threat of something.
Of course they do.
It sounds remarkably like the original Batman the movie, which was released in 1966, where the same team of villains got together, stole a submarine and tried to blow up Gotham. Something about Gotham City.
This time it's
honestly
in space.
I just don't like it.
Now, even though it's animated, Mark, isn't Adam West just getting a little bit old for the thwacking and the kapowing? Like, doesn't he sound... I mean, he didn't actually sound that much older in that clip.
Although, actually, if you listen very carefully, he does sound like this walking frame somewhere in the background. I don't know. It's just a little craggy.
So does this
edges.
Work, this new animated adventure with the old Batman?
It does, because Look, it's just a piece for parents, I think. I mean, kids will just go, oh, cool, isn't that fun? It's another Batman cartoon. And I think parents will be laughing themselves silly all the way through it.
So this will be what your kids are watching, but you will want to watch because you love the original Batman.
Exactly. I think this is a great thing to watch together. And I might point out, it's not just Adam West. Burt Ward, the original Robin, is back.
Of course, he is.
At 71.
He's a spring chicken, Robin.
Just nothing. And then Julie Newmar, the original Catwoman. She's only 83, though.
Yeah.
I don't believe that she's being compelled to wear the suit while she's actually recording.
I dare say not, but I'm sure she signed up for the franchise.
Yes, indeed.
So, in the past on The Big Picture, we've warned parents off some of the seemingly kid-friendly Batman products recently, particularly The Killing Joke that came out this year, which is also an animated film. Does this one demonstrate to us that Batman's becoming safe territory again for all ages?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about the Batman franchise. You know, some of these superheroes are actually sort of becoming less and less accessible to the kid-friendly market that used to read the comics way back when, you know? And so, interestingly, Batman is diverging to two different directions. You're going to still have your Batman v Superman kind of Ben Affleck brooding, let's just blow things up and punch it, versus Lego Batman, as you pointed out, is coming out. Animal Logic, which brought us the Lego movie, is going to be bringing out Batman next year. And then also we've got a second version of this Batman film. So the Return of the Caped Crusaders is actually not the only thing, but the Caped Crusaders, Adam West and co are going to do another one.
They better hurry up. All jokes aside, but they better hurry up.
I know there's no sort of long sort of waits on those sort of things. What I particularly like, though, from a family perspective about the Return of the Caped Crusaders, to see the dynamic duo back in action in this form, is that this of all Batman was a Batman who insisted on keeping his sort of upright moral character all the way through, even while he was fighting crime, okay? So one of my favourite scenes, you know, with Batman is that he's got this bomb, particularly in the original Batman, the movie in 1966, and he's trying to throw it overboard, and he runs to one side of the boat and sees ducks and ducklings, and so he can't throw the bomb in there. Or there's this point where in which he's going to chase the Joker in his high-powered Batmobile, and Robin jumps in next to him, but he doesn't move, and Robin says, "They're getting away, Batman." He says, "Seatbelts, Robin, we almost..." And so, to me, there's a certain thing there that's funny to watch, but at the same time is really good. Because, you see, what we should be telling kids is that, you know, what Jesus says, that grapes aren't gathered from thorn bushes, figs aren't gathered from thistles. You've got to have a certain consistency.
What does that mean?
What Jesus is saying is you've got to have a consistency.
Right.
You can't be fighting crime and be a criminal.
Yes.
Okay. You can't be standing up for justice and be an unjust person. And so I figure that this version of Batman is something we want to put in front of kids because it's a little more consistent. You know, you can't be a person who says Christian things and be unchristian. You know, and to me, that works all the way through life and it works with a cape on.
But you'll have to Google for a select cinema near you if you do want to catch the Return of the Caped Crusaders on the big screen, because it's running for just the next 2 days. But you don't need to worry, because you'll be able to download it digitally from October 11 or buy it on your favorite disc format from November 19. It does star Adam West, Burt Ward and Julie Newmar, and it's rated PG for mild themes and animated violence. Mark, before we get on to the rest of the show, I need to put you out of suspense about this true or false statement that I made. So I'm referring to the original Batman movie that Tim Burton made in the 1980s, the first one that Tim Burton made. Did his costume designer, Bob Ringwood, come up with 25 different cape looks and 6 different head looks for the Michael Keaton's version of Batman so Tim Burton would decide which one to go with?
I think Tim Burton's such a crazy person that he probably wasn't happy with any less. In fact, I want to push it further and say he probably came up with 125 different cape looks.
Oh, mate, you were right the first time. That was all entirely true. You just had to push it too far with the 125. Tim Burton doesn't push it that far. It was only 25 different looks, different cape looks and different head looks. And that came in at a total budget of $250,000, that entire project of working out what Michael Keaton was going to wear on screen.
Wouldn't you like that to be your year? So you just get up in the morning, I wonder what I think Michael will wear today.
Yeah.
Let's come up with
that. And I'm going to get an annual salary of $250,000 for coming up with it.
That'll do me
that
fine.
That was true.
Okay, well, coming up yet, we've got more true things to share with you. Of course, as we've said so far, we've had Hillsong's Let Hope Rise. That'll be up ahead in the show. Plus, Inferno, Dan Brown's new thriller. And, of course, hang around to hear what the Bible has to say about making too many babies.
Hey, welcome back to The Big Picture.
Thanks.
I was talking specifically to you, Mark. Oh, okay. Yes. Oh, yeah, good. Thanks for being here.
Because I had left the room. But now I'm back.
Now
in.
You're back. Good. Look, welcome.
And let me talk about what we've got for press record this week. Hollywood doesn't always go in search of Jesus, but a few years ago, Hollywood filmmakers approached the enormously successful Christian band, Hillsong United, about telling the story of where they come from and why they do what they do. Hillsong United, Let Hope Rise, opened at cinemas on Thursday. In an unusual move, no preview screenings were held, but Ben spoke with Hillsong United Taya Smith about being a global superstar and what she learned about her own faith through watching a documentary basically about herself.
Before we had seen it, like, I was always a little bit nervous because we didn't actually put on this film. This is a Hollywood producer that actually came along to a worship night we had in the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, and he just had, I guess, an encounter with the presence of God. He didn't really know how to describe it because he wasn't a Christian, and he's just like, I don't know what that was, but I want people to experience that, and we need to make a film about it. And that's kind of how it came about. From, you know, the get-go, it's been something that's crazy and something that we didn't imagine would ever happen. But I'm also excited because a lot of my family who aren't Christians and maybe don't really understand or fully see everything that I get to be involved in, say here at church or with Hillsong United, it's kind of exciting because I guess they get to see a glimpse into my life and the people that I do life with, and hopefully even just a glimpse into who Jesus is and why we do what we do.
What about from your side of things though, Taya, what did you learn about yourself and about Hillsong United from Let Hope Rise?
Something that I maybe discovered afresh through the film, I was deeply challenged about my faith and what I actually believe.
Why were you so challenged during the production of the film, of the documentary?
We would sit down and have an interview, just a one-on-one with the director who isn't a Christian, and which is pretty amazing that he was the director, because I guess he was telling an unbiased view of just like opening up the curtain going, okay, who are these people? Who is this Jesus guy? Why do you think people need Jesus? And he was asking those kind of questions. I was challenged just how would I explain who Jesus is and why do I think people need him in everyday kind of language that can relate to someone who has never experienced him before. And so I think I was challenged to not necessarily be so inward focused, or even, I don't know, just like maybe brought up some of the churchisms that I've picked up, you know, being raised in a Christian home, and really challenging, do I believe those like little taglines that sometimes we say in church just off the top of our head? But I was like, do I actually believe that?
And it turns out, Taya, that you do?
Yeah, 100%.
Yes.
But I was challenged to, and I feel like maybe I'm still outworking that with my relationship with God, of going, okay, how do I describe who you are, Jesus? Like, why do I love you? What have you done in my life that I can't ever go back on who you are, or go back to the way things were? Like, it was a process that was very revealing. And I mean, even with the film, like, because we do open up our lives and who we are, and so that can be quite revealing as well.
Did you find that difficult, Taya?
I felt that it was challenging because it was just like, okay, who do I actually say that I am, and am I following through with actually what I believe, and am I able to tell people about Jesus just in small words? And I hope, you know, like, let's be honest, over my whole life, I hope that it would be a lifelong response, and that who I am and my actions would actually speak louder, and that they, you know, that would reflect to, you know, who I believe in. I would hope that even for people who maybe, you know, like, are slightly skeptical about church or who Jesus is, and they just have questions, I hope that they would, you know, come along and see this film, and they might find the cinema a comfortable place to be, and against the church they might not be. So
yes,
I'm kind of stoked for what this could be.
Do you expect that a lot of people will come to see Let Hope Rise that aren't Christian, but have heard about Hillsong United, or heard about Hillsong, or heard about Jesus, and are somehow intrigued by any of those things?
That's my greatest hope. I really hope that, like,
more than if, say, Christians, people who already follow Jesus, more than if they come along to see it.
Well, I feel like, if I'm allowed to say both, I'll tell you why.
You are allowed to say both, Taya.
Okay. Well, both, because first is like the best opportunity for me personally with my family who are, like, on one side they're basically non-Christian. This is the most insane opportunity that I would be able to, like, for example, on Facebook just the other day, my cousin who is like posting a photo about Let Hope Rise, posting a pic of me and saying, this is my cousin, she's in this film, who's going to come see it with me? Like, let's go support our gal. And I'm like, she's not even a Christian. This could be the start of questions about who Jesus is, and even just, you know, potential of just having openness to God and questions, and whether that, like, ends up being like a process that takes years. That's a way in that I've never had before in my family. but also my hope is that Christians will be encouraged. I don't know, there's just something like about being honest and just going, this is who we are. And I hope that that would encourage Christians, that people would look at our lives and not see people who are up on platforms, but see normal people who are doing life and have the same kind of struggles, and just that they would see their life in our story and then go, well, if God could do incredibly extraordinary things through normal people, then he could do that in my life.
Do you remember that little film a few years back that suggested Jesus was actually married to Mary Magdalene?
Oh, yeah. Hang on a second.
Yeah, it was called The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yeah.
Or the follow-up that suggested the Pope was in league with a secret society bent on discrediting science. That was Angels and Demons. Well, the author of those religiously themed thrillers, Dan Brown, is back with the latest novel to film, Inferno, releasing this Thursday. And this time, it seems hell is actually a metaphor for a much more significant earthly destruction at the hands of an all-new secret society.
It's Dante's Inferno.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell 700 years ago.
But these circles of hell have been rearranged.
Why Dante?
Why this map of hell?
Dante. Dante's death mask.
Yes.
We've got to get to Florence.
I need access to the Dante mask.
The Dante mask is no longer here. It was stolen. Here's the security footage.
Professor, that looks like you.
I have no memory of taking that mask.
You did. I just saw you.
Yep, Robert Langdon, Tom Hanks, awakens in a hospital room in Florence, Italy, with no memory of what has transpired over the last few days. He suddenly finds himself once again the target of a major manhunt with the help of Dr. Sienna Brooks, played by Felicity Jones.
That guy, so international manhunts just all the time.
Well, you wouldn't go on holiday, would you?
You would not, just, no.
You really go somewhere.
You really start thinking, maybe I'm the problem.
What is it about secret societies that hate Robert Langdon?
Yeah.
Anyway, his knowledge of symbiology, Langdon tries to find his freedom and his memory, even while he's being pursued by police left, right, and center all over Rome, and while solving the most intricate riddle he's ever faced. Basically, Langdon has this, you know, a figurative trip through Dante's hell. This is the idea, if you know the artist Dante, and Dante basically constructed, well, at least Dante wrote about hell, and Botticelli did a particular picture, you know, inspired by that.
This is many centuries ago, famous story and artwork.
And this becomes the new artwork at the focal point of Inferno, which is basically a thriller from Dan Brown III that's been turned into a film by A-list director Ron Howard.
So what we're just looking at then is a continuation of Dan Brown's like previous old school art mysteries.
Yeah,
just another in the trilogy series of that.
Got it. I mean, the format's pretty much the same. Hanks returns as the art historian Robert Langdon,
yep,
the pesky American professor, you know, who's very, very good at running, it seems, between places. He's just running from one place to another.
Hope he's had a haircut. That mullet was really distracting in the first movie. Well, that's one of the only strong memories I have of that movie. I didn't really like Da Vinci Code very much, but the mullet particularly turned me off.
I mean, the format, continues along with the mullet.
Yes.
We've got a new secret society. I mean, in Da Vinci Code, we have the Opus Dei, who are uncovering the secret priory of Sion. In Angels and Demons, we had the Illuminati. We're out there trying to replace
the Illuminati,
the Pope.
Yes.
Yeah. And in this time, now we've actually got a whole new sort of set of villains called the Consortium. Who I've never heard of. At least that's
because they're
step
a
up.
Secret society, Mark.
Oh, of course.
I was about to ask, how many secret societies can there be? But they're secret, so yeah. I guess we won't discover until Dan Baron's next novel.
Well, I believe that 19 novels down will still have secret societies on that argument.
You've read the novel, haven't you?
Yes. Look, I'm still going through therapy, but I'd like to say that it is. If you liked Dan Brown
and his other work,
you will like Inferno.
Okay.
Because
yes,
there's nothing terribly different.
Right.
Okay. The same hilarious and somewhat hysterical inaccuracies in history, the same strange uses of art in order to sort of push along an ever-thinning plot line. Basically, you're looking at the same sort of thing. And Inferno is really one of those sort of things where all of the paranoia that you could possibly push into religion and secret societies, as you say, and the government doing things behind our backs and all of us on the verge of destruction, we don't know, tinfoil thinking, basic tinfoil hat thinking all the way through.
So you just mentioned, what were they called? The Consortium. Are they the villain in Inferno?
They are. They're basically a society that is protecting an even greater villain who's a geneticist who basically doesn't like people. So his problem is that we've had too many babies and there's a population explosion
going
on.
We've had too many babies?
Well, this is the idea that, you know, some people live by this. Now, I'm personally not the sort of person who holds this theory, so some people might find this really quite personal, but there are people out there who believe that we are approaching a human Armageddon based on the fact that we are having too many children on the planet. The world is overpopulated, and this is putting such a strain on human resources that in the end it will be chaos and death and the fall of civilization as well.
Wow, that's quite a challenging plotline.
And it would be, except that it got picked up by Dan Brown, and now it's got some really interesting twists that make no sense whatsoever. But look, that said, Dan Brown's sort of work is exactly what you would expect it to be. And though, as I said, we should be clear on this, the film previews haven't come out yet at the time we've been sort of sitting down today. And so that means that I haven't been able to see the film, but the book is screaming classic Dan Brown all the way across.
Yeah, yeah. And doesn't sound like you're a fan of Dan Brown or his mysteries for that matter. What's your main issue with them?
Look, my main problem with Dan Brown mysteries is the fact, like the Da Vinci Code, they all rest on the idea that the most important knowledge in the world is actually being hidden. It's a strange sort of paranoia, which I find really hard to stomach, that that we are actually in a world that is dancing on puppet strings of a few secret societies. My biggest objection is that we have to work hard to discover what God really meant by really obvious things. Okay, Jesus came to save the world. No, he didn't. Know he was married and he was doing an early women's rights thing. The Pope is trying to point people to Christ. No, he's not. He's a member of the Illuminati and he's trying to get together, you know, a bomb to blow things up. I mean, it's crazy town. And now when we come to hell, which is quite possibly, you know, so Dante's sort of forte, if you like, and the most important sort of issue that I think that humans should be aware of today, that there's a consequence for not living in relationship with God, it gets turned into a metaphor for something completely different, as if somehow God was trying to hide the truth. And yet, from the very beginning, he's been sending prophets, telling people what he actually wants to say. He's then sent his son, in the last days, as Hebrews puts it, the radiance of the Father and the exact representation of his being, so we know exactly what God's on about.
There's clarity.
Yeah, and then you get someone like Dan Brown coming along and going, actually, no, it's all a game of smoke and mirrors. You don't really know what God's on about. Now, I think the only explanation for this sort of thinking is that when you see what God's on about, you just wish he was on about something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, God is seriously on about saving us from ourselves, but that means we have to admit we have a problem. And that's why I figure that Dan Brown plots work so well and sell so many airport novels, and people will line up to see the films because they'd rather believe a crazy story than a very simple truth.
People will be most likely lining up for Inferno this week because it opens on Thursday, October 13th. It's directed by Ron Howard, rated M for mature themes, violence, and coarse language, and it does star Tom Hanks, Felicity Jones, and Ben Foster.
Now, we have something far more exciting to tell you about than Inferno. You would have thought the release of Inferno was big, but this is, in fact, bigger.
Yes.
This week, we are proud to launch the Big Picture's first Film and TV Award Show.
You even put on a special voice for that.
I did.
Film and TV Award Show.
If I want to do it that way, I go, Film and TV Award Show.
That was very good.
Thank you. We hope that it will become a grand tradition in the years to come, and it's going to be called The Eternals, because we basically hope it'll go on forever. Now, the Eternals, it's basically brought to you by the Bible Society. An eternity newspaper, and we're inviting you, the listener, to have a say in what you think are the most eternally significant film and TV productions to be released this year. What are the characters you most admire, or the family films you'd most like your kids to learn from? The best stories for pointing people to God? There are a whole bunch of categories you can vote on, and you can find them by heading over to thebigpicturewebsite.com from this Monday and casting your votes. Or you can head over to our Facebook page, find your way to an electronic ballot paper of your choice. There's even going to be a link on the Hope 103.2 site later in the week too. So if you're listening to us through their online portal, you actually don't have to go far at all. You could just turn your eyes to the left or something like that. We'll announce the winner of the inaugural Eternals for 2016 in a special show on December 18, our second last show of the year. So don't miss out. Visit thebigpicturewebsite.com and be part of the Eternals.
And coming up on this show, Top five box sets of all time, the ultimate TV theme quiz, and a new thriller about a girl on a train called, wait for it, The Girl on the Train.
Who would have thought? Welcome back.
We've just been chatting about Dan Brown's new art and religion-inspired mystery called Inferno. It's opening at cinemas on Thursday. And that film makes the population explosion out to be the worst bomb that's threatening humanity today. But Hollywood hype aside, though, is population growth something we should be learning to fear? Well, that's a worthy question for our What the Bible Has to Say segment for this week, and an opportunity to make room for the insights of Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator, Greg Clark.
As for you, said God to the sons of Noah after they'd survived the great flood that's described in Genesis in the Bible, as for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. You can read that in Genesis chapter 9. Well, it's a well-known fact that after disasters, life blooms ferociously, abundantly and with enthusiasm. After a bushfire, plants regenerate, flowers bloom, and animals return in great numbers, as if the disaster gave them a new sense of life's goodness and value and beauty, and they can't wait to rebuild something even better than what was lost. It's the same with people. Following World War II, the Western world went into one of its greatest ever building and development phases. Energised by the idea that maybe the worst had passed, and peace would be the order of the day, whole cities were reimagined, industries started, the arts flourished, and the world became wealthier and more full. These dynamics are, I think, a sign that God's creation is supposed to thrive. It's supposed to endure the worst that's thrown at it and always recover, in fact, often benefiting from the disaster by creating something greater. In fact, my own organisation, the Bible Society, was reinvigorated after World War II to become not just Bible distributors, but contributors to the building of good societies, where biblical values such as loving your enemies, seeking the good of the city you live in, and working with diligence and honesty would be paramount. I guess the term for this might be building the spiritual capital of a nation. So when I hear people saying that the world is getting too big, that there are too many people, that there's no room anymore, I have to say I find myself scoffing. It runs against the grain of the Christian view of the world, because we believe in a God of abundance and prosperity, of love and life, and building communities that last. There's plenty to share. The problem is that we don't share it, and we use it selfishly for our own gratification. There's plenty of food, but we hoard it and rape the earth using unsustainable farming practices. There's plenty of room, but we insist on suburban sprawl and one-person homes and backyards and pools and so on. Look, I don't mean to judge anyone. I just think we have to be honest and recognise that the earth really can sustain a growing population, but only if we welcome each and every one of them as equally important as us. I like the image at the end of the Bible in Revelation 21 of the great multitude of heaven descending to earth as a city. There's plenty of room for them, and their city is a glorious place. And all the nations come into this city like some final resting place for the world's refugees. And never has it been more true to say, the more the merrier.
Although it has a title that's about as exciting as doing your tax return, The Girl on the Train is one of the most talked about new releases at cinemas. Starring Emily Blunt as well as a girl who, you guessed it, is on a train, this thriller takes a trip into territory Alfred Hitchcock would applaud. As it does, the journey into relationship nightmares might shock you with what it reveals about facing up to reality.
I saw someone with Megan Hipwell, but not on Friday night. She was having an affair. She had a lover. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
I thought you didn't know her.
No, but I saw her.
You saw her where?
I saw her from the train. She was standing on the deck with this man.
Her husband, Scott Hipwell?
No, it wasn't him. This man was different, and they were kissing.
Wow, that's pretty coincidental, isn't it? You just happened to be on a train at the same exact moment that a woman you don't know but somehow recognize is cheating on her husband?
I know it sounds crazy.
Neighbors saw a drunk woman in the vicinity of her house Friday night. Megan Hipwell does bear a resemblance to Anna Watson.
Okay, Mark. So Emily Blunt is playing Rachel. She's the girl on the train. She's catching this train into New York City.
Is it a
every
nice
day.
Train?
It is quite a nice train. She's not having a particularly nice time on it, though. She's a divorcee, struggling with alcoholism, and she sort of lives her life through fantasy fairy tales that she concocts about people that she sees out the window of the train, particularly a woman that we find out later is called Megan, or Megan, as the American expression would have it. She's played by Hayley Bennett. And also Anna, Rachel Ferguson, comes into this as well. Megan and Anna live on the same street. Rachel sort of sees what's going on in their life to some degree, but particularly focused on Megan. And then Rachel gets swept up in Megan's life because she disappears, Megan that is. And there's a possibility that Rachel's involved with that, even though she doesn't remember because she's blacked out because she had a big night the night before.
Okay, so there's disappearances going on. This actually sounds very much like that recent other thriller, Gone Girl. Is that right?
Yeah. It definitely has got that vibe. Russ Matthews, who's a regular on our show, and he's going to be turning up on our show in the next couple of weeks. Russ, I thought, simplified this down in a review that he wrote on his blog, Rustling Reviews, where he said this is a bit Gone Girl, a bit Fatal Attraction, and a bit Rear Window, the Alfred Hitchcock film. I think he's right, without necessarily saying that this film is as good as those. I wasn't a huge fan of Gone Girl, but I think that was better and stronger than The Girl on the Train. This is based on a novel that came out only last year by a lady called Paula Hawkins that went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So instantly that's going to be made into a movie, of course. And here it is. As all these threads converge, Mark, up on screen of these varying characters, I thought, look, it's enjoyable enough. It's one of those stories, though, that's interesting while it's kind of setting up what's going on and you start learning a little bit more about these characters and how they intertwine. And it's intriguing enough to want to know what exactly is going on with Megan and Rachel and did she do it, et cetera, et cetera. But the more it goes on, and then particularly when you get to the bit where you discover what's happening, I thought a lot of airs went out of the tires at that point, and it wasn't anywhere near as scintillating or mysterious as it sort of tried to lead us to believe.
Oh, okay, so a bit of a disappointment in the mystery stakes.
Yes, very much so. So definitely if people are coming out telling you that The Girl on the Train, if they've read the novel and then they're promoting the film and they're saying it's like Alfred Hitchcock, don't entirely believe them.
No.
There are elements like Alfred Hitchcock, particularly around people's almost hidden agendas and possible secret identities, and then the difficulties that they have assessing reality from fiction, all that kind of stuff. It's all in there, but I think it's a bit lukewarm as opposed to really on the boil.
And it's a feminine tale, clearly. You've got Rachel, Megan, Anna, sort of three strong women characters all the way through. What are we supposed to feel for them, or what do we learn about them?
Yeah, this does feel like a movie that's presenting female characters to us in a way, in a variety of situations that they're in, particularly in their marriages or their relationships where things aren't necessarily going too well. I think we're meant to be feeling for them a lot of sympathy. We're meant to be siding with them. I believe there's an actual real word called misandry. I think that's what the word
is.
The hatred of men. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that The Girl on the Train is out to hate men, but a lot of the male characters up on screen, there aren't that many, but most of them on the screen just aren't terribly nice, and they're not presented in a great light. And as the film goes on and you learn more about how these different relationships interweave, there's a very strong vibe, particularly as we get to the climax, that I walked out, and maybe it's because I'm a bloke, but I walked out feeling a little bit attacked to some degree. I think Gone Girl had this as well, but I think that was more of an attack on marriage itself. Mm. This one feels like it's really having a go at blokes. So I think it wants us to side with Rachel, Megan, and Anna, even in their shortcomings, even in their failings, even in situations that they should just get themselves out of, but they're not. They're digging themselves in further. I think we're still meant to be siding with them.
Gosh, it's still men's fault. Okay. Well, okay.
We might be overstating the case, though.
I know. I guess you can't. It's kind of interesting because it's very easy to point the finger the other way. You'll often have commentators say, oh, this is a misogynistic piece.
Hatred of women.
Yeah.
But it's definitely got an undercurrent of dudes aren't cool.
Yeah. Not nice at all. Okay. Well, you shouldn't give away what's going on in Gone Girl. Sorry, you shouldn't give away what's going on in The Girl on the Train. But will it stir up viewers? Will they be like, oh, wow, thrilled? Or
look, I think so. And again, particularly if you haven't read the novel like I hadn't when I went into it, there's enough to keep you going along on this journey. Emily Blunt puts in a pretty strong performance. She's not entirely believable as this woman who's on the precipice of reality and fantasy and is a struggling alcoholic. I thought Hayley Bennett, Rebecca Ferguson did well with their characters. Allison Janney is in this. She's best known for The West Wing, I think. She's in this as a detective and is great in any scene that she's in. And Luke Evans and Justin Theroux, who's best known as the husband of Jennifer Aniston now, they're also in the cast as the blokes that aren't painted in a great light, but I thought they did a good job. So the cast is good. It's by a director called Tate Taylor, who made The Help. This film isn't anywhere near as good as Help as The Help. As you're going through all this mystery and you get to find out what's exactly going on, what it'll stir up in you is all kinds of feelings about relationships and how people treat each other and how people should respond to that. And if your own marriage or relationship is in a terrible state, you will have all kinds of emotions dredged up about that. Or if you suffer from alcoholism, you'll have all sorts of emotions stirred up. But what it stirred up in me, Mark, was similar to what Inferno stirred up in you in terms of Dan Brown with Inferno and how he likes to present what he thinks is going on in the real world. I thought the Girl on the Train was a good reminder about, or a good challenge to ourselves and for our friends and our family around us. Are we helping them see what the reality of a situation is? There's a lot in The Girl on the Train, particularly in its setup of the Rachel character daydreaming out the window and basically trying to go through her life in a fantasy and living through a fantasy of other people's lives as she tries to ignore what's going on in hers because she can't really deal with it. I think the challenge then is something along the lines of recently at church, I got to do a sermon on Psalm 1. Psalm 1 is an amazing encapsulation of the reality of life, which basically boils down to, are we living God's way or some other way? That is what reality is. That's the kind of presentation of reality that we can be helping ourselves and our friends and our family learn in all kinds of situations and remember and live out, as opposed to The Girl on the Train, which basically was almost a skewering of the idea that you could live a fantasy existence and think that it's going to go well for you. So that's what it stirred up in me. I think it'll stir that up in viewers. But what mainly will be stirred in people is that The Girl on the Train is mediocre. It's okay. And it's not quite as mysterious or intriguing as you might have thought it was at the start.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, The Girl on the Train stars Emily Blunt, Hayley Bennett, Rebecca Ferguson, and Allison Janney. It opened last Thursday at cinemas everywhere, not just on the trains, and is rated MA15+ for strong themes and violence. And I understand there's some sexual content, too.
Yes. So, yeah, there is. It's surprising that didn't sneak into the rating because it's actually quite vivid. Not quite as strong as Gone Girl, which is terribly graphic, but there's plenty of sexual content in this that will disturb some viewers.
Okay, we'll be clear on that. Okay, what's coming up?
Mate, still to come on the show, are you a huge fan of TV? If you are, we're about to put that to the test before Mark unveils the top 5 box sets of all time.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Well, listen, we've come to that part of the show where we like to talk about soundtracks. And because at the end of the show, in the top 5, we'll be talking about the top 5 box sets of all time.
All time.
As far as TV's concerned anyway. Because, of course, we won't be talking about the Star Trek movie box set. I just want to make it clear for people who might have been hanging out.
You had to get a
that.
Star Trek reference in.
Okay, there we go. So we're going to be talking about that later in the show. So I thought, well, why not for our soundtrack segment this week, why not test Ben's acumen again
when
it comes to TV themes?
Yeah, I always do so well at these quizzes where we play themes from something and I have to guess what they are. Like so, everybody else, I'm sure everybody else listening in will guess it instantly. I usually struggle a little
bit. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we thought we'd play some of the best and most notable TV themes of all time so that you can guess them along with Ben and feel superior to him.
Okay.
Ben, how about we try the first one?
All right, then.
Any idea? Come on now, I thought we'd start off with an easy one.
Is that, so, that's an easy one?
That's an easy one.
Man. Sounds
there
something science fiction-y. They are.
Oh.
But what is it? I can't picture what that is.
It's Sherlock.
Sherlock?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even really like that show.
What?
Yeah.
You heard
it right.
As Sherlock Holmes and Martin Freeman as Dr. John Watson, the latest recreation of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle thing. No? Okay, well, let's just call that a starter. Let's do 5 from now.
Okay.
That was a warm-up.
All right, thank you.
Okay, this one's an absolute classic. How are you going so far? You're looking perplexed.
Mark, this is a wise way these quizzes like baffle me because I recognize this tune, but I am really struggling to place the TV show it's from.
Let me give you a clue. Joss Whedon.
Oh, So you're talking Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
This is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There you go, with Sarah Michelle Gellar as Buffy Summers, you know, screaming through the night, stabbing all sorts of nasties. Good. We'll call that one.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Let's go for number three.
Nodding straight away. You've got this one right.
Thank you. I thought this list was just going to be full of stuff that you like. But thankfully, at number three, you picked something I really, really like, which is the American version of The Office. and by the American version of The Office, I mean Parks and Recreation.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, I was so confident. Oh, okay. And then thankfully, the look on your face reminded me that that theme is indeed from Parks and Recreation.
You're kind of close to an American political comedy television sitcom starring Amy Poehler as Leslie Knope, a perky mid-level bureaucrat in the Parks Department of Pawnee, Indiana.
Wow, great okay. save. Great save, Ben. Well great done. Save. Let's move on.
Okay.
Mate, this is not ringing any bells at all. It sounds kind of West Wingy, like sweeping and grand.
World War II.
World War II? You mean Band of Brothers?
Band of Brothers.
That's there Band of Brothers?
That's Band of Brothers. It's epic music. It's beautiful music.
Mate, are these all shows that you really like?
No, they're popular shows.
Thank you for that. So, all right, let's go to number five.
Okay, please. Oh, that's just the HBO sound effect at the beginning.
That's HBO.
Yeah. Come on.
The Sopranos.
It's The Sopranos.
And that's I can good. Say that with absolute confidence.
Now, you see, because we disallowed Sherlock because that was just too confusing for you, you're actually sitting on 2 out of 4.
Yes.
So you've got a chance to get over 50%.
Oh, okay, great. All right.
With the final
All right. Let's go. Body Towers.
It's a gift.
That's a loving gift, my friend, to
John
me.
Cleese.
Thank you.
Is the fictional hotel manager in the seaside town of Torquay on the English Riviera. And who could forget Manuel?
Mate, what did I get? 3 out of 6 for our ultimate TV themes.
Well, let's say 3 out of 5 because we're not counting sure.
Okay, I passed.
There you go. Well done. A good 50% for you. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the top five as we conclude our show for this week. The highlight I always look forward to in this week's top five is the top five TV box sets. Now, look, this is pretty hard.
Mate, that's very hard.
It's very hard.
I'm glad this is you doing this.
This is me giving you guaranteed Christmas presents you can ask of others that you won't regret receiving.
Oh.
Okay.
These are ones we're getting in early before Christmas. It's very helpful.
We're running into the Christmas season and you're starting to wonder, what am I going to buy for the couch potato who has everything? Well, why not buy them a box set so they never actually get up?
Okay. Okay, and then at number
5.
I'm going to start us off with the Bizarre Comedy Box Set. Okay, now there's lots of things that could sit in the category of Bizarre Comedy Box Set, like Community. Okay,
yes,
that's good fun.
Great show. That's not hit, not on the list.
It's not, no. Or Arrested Development.
Or that's not on the list.
Not on the list. Or Fawlty Towers. Okay,
Not on the list.
You've got it. But what I'm picking for my Bizarre Comedy Box Set ran from 2001 to 2010, Scrubs.
Oh, yeah, okay. I can see what you're doing with this.
A funny little thoughtful show about
how many seasons? Is that like 9 seasons?
9 seasons right. of Scrubs. Probably should have stopped at about 4.
Yes. So if you first couple smashed it and then they stopped smashing it.
Exactly. Okay, so JD or, you know, Dr. John Dorian, played by Zach Braff, basically a great comedy. And one of the best features about it is the whole idea of seeing life through his daydreams about what things might actually be
oh,
like.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, great fun. Let's move on.
4.
I thought for the 4th box set, we could have a look at the Weird Community box set. Okay,
isn't Community, though.
No, it's not Community, but always a strange sort of insight into a world that we're not quite aware of. And it's the sort of thing like Fargo sits inside of that, like police in Nebraska.
But Fargo's not on the list?
No, or Entourage would be another one that would fit in this category, which is also not on the list. Okay. Have you not picked up the format yet?
Really trying to keep up.
Okay. On what I picked, 2007 to 2015, go out and grab yourself a handful of Mad Men.
Oh, okay? Yeah, Mad Men, okay, yes.
It's that whole superb dialogue, sumptuous camera work, gorgeous outfits, Matthew Weiner's series about people in the advertising agencies of Madison Avenue in New York in the 50s and 60s.
Mm, but be warned, as amazing as it visually looks and also as quite stunning as the scripting was and the performance, The show can be quite hard-hitting at times, particularly when it comes to relationships, everything from sex scenes to just the implosion of marriages particularly, and infidelity is rife in the show,
It's right at a pivotal point in history where people are struggling to work out those sort of key things of what is marriage about, what is fidelity about, what is faithfulness
about. What are the relationships or the roles or the ways that men and women should relate with each other in everyday life, be it in a marriage or in the workplace. All of that bundled into Mad Men.
Well worth watching 92 episodes over 7 seasons.
Only 92 seasons. Episodes?
Only a mere 92. But let's move on to the even better.
3.
Mean Streets box set. Okay, there's always that sort of series that's all about the mean streets. The Sopranos works, you know, in that context. Okay?
Not on the list.
Okay, listen.
Just making it clear.
Making it longer is what you're doing. Okay, and guess what's not on the list?
What's not on the list?
Boardwalk Empire is not on the list. Okay, so you get the idea when I talk about the Mean Streets box set. But of course, both of these would be trumped by The Wire.
I was hoping you were heading in that direction.
Yeah, David Simon's crime drama masterpiece set in Baltimore about the state of inner city modern America. Memorable characters, nuanced and complex moral realities, sharp dialogue, sexual content, violence, we're warning you, okay? But 60 episodes over 5 seasons, an incredible thing. Quite possibly, except for the next two that are coming, some of the best TV ever written.
Agreed.
2.
But then we come to one of my personal favourites, and I don't know why I didn't put this at number one. Oh, yes, I do. I see what I put at number one. Okay, but honestly, this is so close. The political thriller box set. Now, you might be thinking you like House of Cards. Lots of people watch that.
I don't mind House of Cards.
Okay, but
so that's
honestly,
a number two. That's not on the list
no,
either.
No, it's not.
Oh, Mark, I can't believe you keep fooling me with this every time.
I know, because
you keep setting me up and knocking me down.
Because House of Cards is great, but a pale shadow to the West Wing.
The old West Wing.
That whole sort of ace politics-based drama about life in the White House, high-level debate, great characterization, full of witty dialogue, and in addition, so much fast walking that you can actually use this series as a workout tape. You
know, they do like to walk and talk in that show, don't they?
Walk all the time.
There is so much walking and talking in the dimly lit corridors of the White House.
And what's more, I particularly love a box set that gives you longevity. 7 seasons, 155-hour-long episodes.
Not only is that quality TV, that's value for money.
That's value for money, and it'll sit nicely on the shelf. It'll probably hold all the other books up.
1.
But basically, my favourite franchise of all time that sits inside a box set at my house ran from 1972 to 1983, actually ran 3 times longer than the war it chronicled. I'm talking about MASH.
So MASH makes the list?
MASH is number one.
MASH is number one on the list.
So that's not a hint away from what they
say. Okay. I thought I was finally up to the format. Turns out I'm not.
No. MASH is, in fact, what I think is one of the best. Look, if you've never heard of MASH, oh, shame on you.
I know. Where have you been? You've been born in the last 20 years, maybe.
It's an incredible series based on the 4077 Mobile Army Surgical Hospital during the Korean War. It's loosely based on real events. Army surgeon Hawkeye Pierce is featured as the main character, who's played by Alan Alda. It struggled, interestingly. This series struggled in its first season. Was actually at risk of being cancelled, but then went on to produce 11 seasons, 251 episodes.
Value for money.
Okay, there you go, value for money. It's ranked number 25 in TV Guide's top 50 shows of all time.
But not on the Mark Hadley list.
No, it's at number one. Okay. In fact, the final episode, Goodbye, Farewell and Amen, was the most watched and highest rated single television episode in US television history of all time. Okay, I mean, comparatively, when you compare population growth, that's it. This is the most watched television. It had 77% of the market at the time, watching 125 million people going up. Look, it's a laugh-out-loud comedy. It borrows a great deal from the Marx Brothers' absurdism. In fact, interestingly, it was released With a laugh track in the United States, and Alan Alda is really quite funny.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think I've seen that on reruns.
But it wasn't released with a laugh track in the UK. And I think in one respect it allowed it to come out as the political insight that it was. Because the series spent a great deal of time talking about Vietnam, about war, because the Vietnam War was still in progress, but they could use the Korean War as kind of a foil to talk about that. And it talked about the futility of men playing gods on the battlefield, hoping to determine what's going to happen, and then trying to pick up the pieces in an operating theater. It's serious, lovely, funny, and also insightful.
You want to see agitated? I can be aggravated, infuriated, frustrated, vexated, and irritated.
Maybe Hawkeye and I should talk alone for a while.
Yeah, that's good. When do we do that? Go, what are you waiting for?
I don't know. I just thought there might be something we wanted to say to each other before I left.
So tell me the next time you see me. I'm not going to be here forever. I can guarantee you that.
So, Mark, as much as I had trouble keeping up with your list of what was actually on it, good choice coming in there at the end. I don't know if I would have picked MASH as number one, but I can see why you did. And just listening to those 25 seconds of gold from MASH makes me want to run back and watch it.
Yeah, Alda's an incredible actor, funny, and at the same time cutting all the way through. Brilliant. You've got to meet that character.
Yeah. You do, and you've also got to meet us next week because what's coming up on the show, Mark?
Indeed, new Aussie offerings on the big and small screen, Boys in the Trees and The Secret Daughter.
We've also got Cafe Society, the new Woody Allen comedy drama about hanging out in vintage Hollywood.
And not since the birth of movies has there been something so new and amazing as what The Big Picture will unveil next week.
In short, we're going to unveil something incredible on the show next week. You need to join us where I will still be, and this won't be the amazing revelation. I'll be Ben McKechnie.
And I'll be Mark Hadley. See you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.